Could you imagine being so infamous that they made a folk song about it? Well, today we're going to go over Lizzie Borden.
We here at Angry Me Production want to thank our sponsor, Mobile Notary Mindy. She's certified with the National Notary Association. She's also bonded and E&O insured. She offers a wide range of services including wills, powers of attorney, medical documents, healthcare proxies, living wills, certification of trust, assignment of personal property, HIPAA waivers, advanced healthcare directives, and 99 verification. You can find her on Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram at Mobile Notary Mindy. You can also visit her webpage at TexasMobileNotaryMindy.com. That's TXMobileNotaryMindy.com. Thank you so much and enjoy the show.
Ladies and gentlemen of all ages, boys and girls, thank you for tuning in to yet another episode of Angry Me Production. We appreciate you coming in and letting us be a part of your lives. Week in and week out. We hope to do our best to present you with something that your eardrums delight in. Whether you're looking at us on YouTube or Rumble, or listening to us on Spotify, Google, or Anchor, or any of the other podcast services that we are currently on or trying to get on, we thank you. And if you don't mind, at the end of every episode, stop by, leave us a comment, leave us a like. If it asks for 5 stars, we'll take 5 stars, even if you don't like us. 5 stars are what it's all about. With that being said, we hope you enjoy our attempt to make our advocation our vocation. Ladies and gentlemen, let the games begin.
Welcome, Angry Faithful. Yes, I know, I told everybody I was going to do Joseph Stalin this week, and it's going to be a couple of them, but I think I'm going to hold off for that for a little bit. A lot of stuff on it, and it's going to be a while. But let's go over Lizzie Andrew Borden. Lizzie Andrew Borden was born July 19th, 1860, in the Fall River, Massachusetts, to Sarah Anthony Borden and Andrew Jackson Borden, which is kind of strange. I guess back then some people like put their father's middle name in there as a middle name, which is strange. And anyways, her father was a English and Welsh descendant, growing up in the modest surroundings and struggled financially as a young man, despite being the descendant of wealthy and influential local residents. Andrew eventually prospered in the manufacturing and sales of furniture and caskets. Then becoming successful property developer, he was a director of textile mills and owned a considerable commercial property. He was also president of the Union Savings Bank and a director of Dolphy Safe Deposit and Trust Company. At his death, his estimated value was $300,000, roughly $9.63 million. By 2023. Despite his wealth, Andrew was known to be frugal. For instance, the Borden residence lacked indoor plumbing, even though at the time it was common occurrence for the wealthy to have indoor plumbing. Could you imagine that, though, that you're in the wintertime and everybody around you has plumbing, but you have to go to an outhouse to take a dump? I would be pissed every day. The house stood in a affluent area, but the wealthiest residents of River Falls, including Andrew's cousins, generally lived more fashionable neighborhood called the Hill, which was his was farther from the industry area of the city. Sorry, Lizzie and her older sister Emma. Laura Lauren Burden, burnt. Stephen Hawking from the grave. I know I'm making a mistake on this, but please, please help us out.
Borden.
I don't know why I messed up on that. I had to hear it just so I could say it. I was, anyways, had a relative religious upbringing and attended Central Congregational Church. As a young woman, Lindsay was very involved in the church activities, including teaching Sunday school to the children of the residents immigrants to the United States. She was also involved in religious organizations such as Christian Endeavor Society, for which she served as secretary treasurer, and complementary social movement such as the Woman Christian Temperance Union. She was a member of the Ladies Fruit and Flower Mission, which it doesn't give any details on that. The other ones were organization and which among the first organization of women developed to social reform with a program that linked the religious and secular through contra and far reaching reform strategies based. If anybody tell me what the hell that was in the comments, I would be graciously appreciated, because I was like, I'm going to learn something new. Ah, I'm still stupid. Anyways, 3 years after the death of Lizzie's mother, Andrew married Abby Duffy Gray. Lizzie later stated that she called her stepmother Mrs. Borden, and demurred on whenever they had a cordial relationship. She believed that Abby had married her father for his wealth. Bridget Sullivan, whom they called Maggie, the Borden's 25-year-old live-in maid who had immigrated from United States from Ireland, testified that Lizzie and Emma rarely ate meals with their parents. In May of 1892, Andrew killed a couple multiple pigeons in his barn with a hatchet, believing they were attracting local children to hunt them. Wow, that's weird. Lizzie had recently built a roost for the pigeons, and it has been commonly recounted that she was upset about the killings of the pigeons. Though veracity of this has been disputed. A family argument in July 1892 prompted both sisters to take extended vacation to New Bedford. After returning to Fall River a week before the murders, Lizzie chose to stay at a local rooming house for 4 days before returning to the Borden residence. Tension had been growing within the Borden family in the months before the murders, especially over Andrew's gift of real estate to various branches of Abby's family. After their stepmother sisters received a house, the sisters demanded and received a rental property, the home they had lived in until their mother died, which they purchased for purchased from their father for $1. I wish I could purchase something for a house for $1. Man, that's okay. I guess different times. A few weeks before the murders, they sold the property back to their father for $5,000, an equivalent of $163,000 to today's time. The night before the murders, John Vicini Morris, Lizzie and Emma's maternal uncle, visited and was invited to stay for a few days to discuss business matters with Andrew, leading to suspicions that their conversation, and particularly about the property transfer, may have aggravated an already tensioned situation. For several days before the murders, the entire household had been violently ill. A family friend later suspected that lamb chops left on the stove to to use as meal over several days was the cause. Basically, they got food poisoning. Given that Andrew had not been a popular man in River Falls, he feared that he's been poisoned. But on Thursday, August 4th, 1892, Morris arrived in the evening of August 3rd and slept in the guest room that night. After breakfast the next morning, in which Andrew, Abby, and Lizzie, and Morris, and Sullivan were present, Andrew and Morrison went to the sitting room. It's basically a living room now, but that's what a sitting room is. Where they chatted for nearly an hour. Morris left around 8:48 a.m. to buy a pair. How do you get that, like, to the letter or to the number on when you left? That's kind of weird. To buy a pair of oxen and visit his niece in Fall River, planning to return to the Borden home for lunch at noon. Andrew left for his morning walk sometime after 9 a.m. Although the cleaning of the guest room was one of Lindsay's and Emma's regular chores, Abby went upstairs sometime before 9 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. to make the bed. According to a forensics investigation, Abby was facing her killer at the time of the attack. She was first struck on the side of the head with a hatchet, which cut her just above the ear, causing her to turn and face down on the floor, creating concussion on a contusion, I'm sorry, on her nose and forehead. Her killer then struck her multiple times, delivering 17 more direct hits to the back of her head, killing her. When Andrew returned to returned home around 10:30 a.m., his keys failed to open the door, so he knocked. Sullivan went to the Sullivan went to unlock the door, finding it jammed. She uttered a curse. She would later testify that she heard Lizzie laughing immediately after this. She did not see Lizzie, but stated that the laughter was coming from the top of the stairs. This was considerably significant, as Abby was already dead at this time. Andrew, not Abby. God, I messed that whole thing up, I think. Now I'll go back and check. Was already dead by this time, and her body would be would have been visible to anyone in the home on the second floor. Lizzie later denied being upstairs and testifies that her father had asked her where Abby was, to which she replied that a messenger had delivered Abby a summons to visit a sick friend. Sullivan stated that she had then removed Andrew's boots, helped him into his slippers before laying down on the sofa for the nap. A detailed construct by the crime scene photos, which showed Andrew wearing boots. Okay, that's weird. She testified that she was in the third floor room, resting from cleaning windows, when just at 11:10 a.m., she heard Lizzie's call from downstairs. Maggie, come quick. Father's dead. Somebody came in and killed him. Andrew was slumped onto the couch in the downstairs sitting room, struck 10 to 11 times with a hatchet-like weapon. One of his eyes had been split clearly into two, suggesting that he had been sleeping when the attack occurred. His still bleeding wound suggested a very recently attacked. Dr. Barones, a family physician, arrived at his home across the street and pronounced both of the victims dead. Detectives estimated that Andrew's death had occurred approximately 11 a.m. Lizzie initially answered, and by the way, this is like 1890, so I'm guessing they had forensics like this by that time frame. It's kind of weird that you hear about this type of forensic investigation at that time frame, because I barely knew anything about human bodies or anything like that. So Lizzie's initial answer to the police officer's questions were at the time strange and contradictory. Initially, she reported hearing a groan or a scraping noise or a distress call before entering the house. 2 hours later, she told police that she had heard nothing and entered the house, not realizing that anything was wrong. When asked where her stepmother was, she reckoned Abby received a note asking her to visit her sick friend. She also stated that she thought Abby had returned and asked if someone could go upstairs and look for her. Sullivan and a neighbor, Mrs. Churchill, were halfway up the stairs, their eye level with the floor, when they looked into the guest room and saw Abby facing down on the floor. Most of the officer who interviewed Lizzie's reported that they disliked her attitude. Some said she had she was too calm and poised, despite her behaving a changing alibis. Okay. Sorry. She was not checking for blood stains. The police did search her room, but it was curiously inspection. At the trial, they admitted that to not doing a proper search because Lizzie was not feeling well. Oh my God. Nowadays, they don't really care. They were essentially criticized for the lack of diligence. Yeah, I would be too. In the basement, police found two hatchets, two axes, and a hatchet head that had a broken handle. The hatchet head was suspected of being the murder weapon, as the break of the handle appeared fresh, and the ash and dust on the head, unlike that of the other blade tools, appeared to have been deliberately applied to make it look that as if it has been this in the basement some time. However, none of these tools was removed from the house because of the mysterious illness that had struck the household before the murders. Basically, they all have food poisoning. The family's milk and the victim's stomachs removed during the autopsy performed in the Borden dining room. Wow. Were tested for poison. The milk I can understand, but they checked the stomach on the table for the autopsy in their house. That's wow. Okay. Wow. None was found. No poison was found. Residents suspected Lizzie of purchasing hydrocidic? Hold on. Stephen Hawking's from the Gave. Please help me out with this.
Hydrocyanic acid.
Hydrocyanic acid in the diluted form from the local druggist. I wonder if he could buy that now. Okay. Her defense was that she inquired about the acid in order to clean her furs, despite the local medical examiner testimony that it did not have a antiseptic properties. Okay. Use it for cleaning, but okay. All right. Weird. Lizzie and Emma's friend, Alice Russell, decided to stay with the sisters the night following the murders, while Morris spent the night in the attic guest room. Contrary to later accounts that he slept in the murder site's guest room. I'm not saying that people did weird shit back then or weird stuff like that, but they did. People would like, hey, can I sleep in the... I mean, even nowadays, people would want to do that, sleep in the murder room or whatever. People are weird. Police were stationed around the house on the night of August 4th, during which an officer said he had seen Lizzie enter the cellar with Russell carrying a kerosene lamp and a slop pail. He stated he saw both women exit the cellar, after which Lizzie returned alone. Though he was unable to see what she was doing, he did state it would appear that she had bent over this in the sink. I guess cleaning something. On August 5th, Morris left the Borden residence and was mobbed by hundreds of people. Police had to escort him back into the house. The following day, police conducted a more thorough search of the house, inspecting the sister's clothes and confiscating a broken handle hatchet head. That evening, police officers and the mayor visited the house. Lizzie was informed that she was a suspect of the murders. And the next morning, Russell entered the kitchen to find Borden tearing up a dress. She explained that she was planning to put it into the fire because it was covered in paint. It was never determined whether it was of the dress she had been wearing the day of the murders. I can't believe. Okay, so they're... Anyways, I can't believe they would let someone burn clothes. I guess nowadays, you know, it's more thought because stupid stuff like this happen all the time. Anyways, Lizzie appeared at the inquest hearing on August 8th. Her request to her family's attorney be present was refused under the state statute providing that an inquest must be held in private, which that's actually illegal. She had been procured a regular dose of morphine to calm her nerves. Oh, you could buy that over the counter back then. Man, could you imagine buying morphine over the counter nowadays? It's basically heroin. But, you know, anyways, it is possible that her testimony was affected by this. Her behavior was erratic, and she had often refused to answer a question, even if it was an answer that would be beneficial to her. She'd often contradict herself and provide alternate accounts of the morning in question. Well, she was on morphine, so yeah. Such a stated, she saying she was in the kitchen reading a magazine when her father arrived home. Then saying that she was in the dining room doing some ironing, and then saying that she was coming down the stairs. The district attorney was very aggressive and confrontational. Stephen Hawking, from the grave, please help me out with this one.
Confrontational.
Thank you. I know it makes me seem more stupid because I can't do confrontational, but, you know, getting... On August 11th, Lizzie was served with an arrest warrant and jailed. The inquest testimony was based on the modern debate regarding Lizzie's guilt or innocence. Was later ruled indismissible at her trial in June 1893. Contemporary newspapers articles noted that Lizzie possessed a solid demeanor and bit her lip, flushed, and bent towards the attorney Adams. It was also reported that the testimony provided in an inquest had caused a change in opinion among her friends, who had henceforth strongly maintained her innocence. In a request received significant press, attended nationwide, including an extensive 3-page written up in Boston Globe. A grand jury began hearing the evidence on November 7th, and Borden was indicted on November 2nd. Come on. Lizzie's trial took place in New Bedford starting on June 5th, 1893. Prosecutors' attorneys were Hensel M. Knowlton and future U.S. Supreme Court Judge William H. Moody. Defending her, Andrew V. Jensen, and Mumbling owned Adams and former Massachusetts Governor George D. Robinson. 5 days before the trial commenced on June 1st, another axe murder occurred in River Falls. This time, the victim was Martha Manchester, who was found hacked to death in her kitchen. summit between the Manchester and Borden murders were striking and noted by the juries. However, Oscar de Malta, a Portuguese immigrant, was later convicted of murder, Manchester's murders in 1994. And was determined not to have been in a victim of in the vicinity of Falls River at the time of the Bourne murders. A prominent point of discussion in the trial or press coverage of it was the hatchet head found in the basement, which was not conveniently demonstrated by the prosecution of the murder to be the murder weapon. Prosecutors argued that the killer had removed the handle because it had been covered in blood. The officers testified that a hatchet handle was found near the hatchet head, but another officer contracted. Stephen Hawking, you're gonna have to.
Contradicted
this. Though no bloody clothing was found at the scene, Russell testified on August 8, 1992, she had witnessed Lizzie's burning a dress in the kitchen stove, saying that it had been ruined by a brush brushing against wet paint. During this, the course of this trial, defense never attempted to challenge this statement. Lizzie's presence at the home was also a point of dispute during the trial. According to testimony, Sullivan entered the second floor around 10:58 a.m., and left Lizzie and her father downstairs. Lizzie told several people at this time. She went into the barn and was not in the house for 20 minutes or possibly a half an hour. Hammond Lumpskis testified for the defense that he had seen Lizzie leaving the barn at 11:03. How are they getting this time stamp? Are they looking at a watch as they, it was like, oh, Lizzie Bourne. Oh. Look at the time. Might want to annotate that. They got it down to seconds. I would be severely impressed. Charles Gardner conferred at the time. At 11:10, Lizzie called Sullivan downstairs and Lizzie called Sullivan downstairs and told her Andrew had been murdered and ordered her not to enter the room. Instead, Lizzie sent her to go get a doctor. Both victims had been removed during the autopsy, and the skulls were admitted as evidence during the trial and pressed at June 5th, 1893. Upon seeing them in the courtroom, Lizzie fainted. Evidence was executed that she had sought to purchase hydrogen chloride, which is prussic acid, properties for cleaning a sealskin cloak from the local druggist on the day of the murders. The judge ruled that the incident was too removed in the time to have been any connection. The proceedings associated Justin Drew, who had been appointed by Robinson's when he was governor, delivered a lengthy summary that supported the defense as he charged to the jury before it sent to deliberation on June 20th, 1893. After an hour and a half of deliberation, the jury acquitted Lizzie Bourne of the murders. Upon exiting the court, she told reporters that she has the happiest woman in the world. Drew had been compared to later trials of Bruno Richard Hauptmann, Ethel Julius Brownsburg, and O.J. Simpson. As a landmark in public. Publicly and public interest in American legal proceedings. I was about to say that. This is almost like an O.J. Simpson trial. Even though I guess it would be Lizzie Borden trial was just like O.J. Simpson's trial. Or, you know what I mean. Anyways, Although acquitted at the trial, Lizzie remained a prime suspect in her father's and stepmother's murder. Writer Victoria Lincoln proposed in 1967 that she might have committed the murders while in a vague state. It's a mental or behavioral disorder that is classified Barris as a dissociated disorder, a conversion disorder, and a systematic disorder. Disorder of rare. And basically, your mind wasn't in there. You didn't remember actually murdering these people, which is actually possible. Another prompt suggestion was that she was physically and sexually abused by her father, which drove her to kill him. What about the mother? But anyway, well, I guess if she felt that the mother, the stepmother, basically helped out with the sexual assault, then she would kill them too. There is a little evidence to support this, but incest is not a topic that would have been discussed at the time. And the method of collecting physical evidence would have been quite different in 1892. This belief was intimate in local papers at the time of the murders and was revisited by a scholar. I'm going to have Stephen Hawking do this one.
Marcia Carlyle.
Marcia Carlyle in a 1992 essay. Mystery author Evan Hunter, also known as Ed McBain, in his 1984 novel Lizzie, suggested that Lizzie committed the murders after being caught in a tryst with Solomon. You know, I'm going to have to find out what a tryst is, because that is a weird terminology that I have no idea what it means. A private romance between lovers. Okay. That, okay. With Sullivan. Oh, wow. Okay. Back to the thing. Okay. McBride elaborated his suspicion in a 1999 interview, suspecting that Abby had caught the two together and reacted with horror and disgust, and that Lizzie had killed Abby with a candlestick. Okay. She made a confession to Andrew when he returned home, but killed him in a rage with a hatchet when he reacted exactly as Abby had. He further suspected that Sullivan disposed of the hatchet somewhere afterwards. In later year, Lizzie was rumored to be a lesbian, but there was no such speculation about Sullivan, who later married a man she had met while working as a maid in Butte, Montana. Sullivan died in Butte in 1948. Allegations, she gave a deathbed confession to her sister in which she stated that she had changed her testimony on the stand in order to protect Lizzie. There is another significant suspect, and is John Morrison, Lizzie's maternal father or maternal uncle. God, sorry. All right, who rarely met with the family after his sister died, but had slept in the house the night before the murders. According to law enforcement, he had proven an absurdly perfect and over-detailed alibi for the death of Abby Borden. Morris considered a suspect by police for a period of time. William Borden. A man named William Borden, suspected to be Andrew's illegitimate son, was known as a possible suspect by author Arnold Brown, who surmised that William had tried and failed to extort money from his alleged father. Author Leonard Roberto, after extensive research on William, proved that he was not Andrew's son. Emma Borden. Although Emma Borden had an emboli at Fairhaven, about 15 miles from Fall River, crime writer Frank Springings suspected in his 1984 book Lizzie that she might have secretly visited the resident to kill her parents before returning home to Fairhaven in a time to receive the telegram informing her of the murders. Later in life, after the trial, the Borden sisters moved into a large modern home in the hills, modern for that time frame, neighborhood in Fall River. Around this time, Lizzie began using the name Elizabeth A. Borden at their new house, which Elizabeth dubbed Maplecroft. They had a staff that included 11 maids, a housekeeper, and a coachman. Because Abby was ruled to have died before Andrew, her estate went first to Andrew and then, at his death, passed into his daughters as part of his estate. A considerable statement, however, was paid to settle claims by Abby's family. Basically, they paid the family off. So they didn't want to come back and try to get money from Lizzie Borden or anything, or the family thereof. Despite the acquittal, Lizzie was obstructed by River Falls society. Her name was again brought into the public eye when she was accused of shoplifting in Providence, Rhode Island in 1897. In 1905, shortly after the arrangement over the argument over the a party that Elizabeth had given for actress Nancy O'Neill, Emma moved out of the house and never was seen again. Lizzie was ill in her last year following the removal of a gallbladder, and she died of pneumonia on June 1st, 1927. In Fall River at the age of 66. Funeral details were not published and few attended. 9 days later, Emma died of a cardiac nephritis. It's a term used for several kidney disease. Oh, she had a kidney disease. Okay. In a nursing home in New Market, New Hampshire. Having moved to this location in 1923, both for health reasons and to avoid renewed attention following the publicity of another book about the murders, the Borden sisters, never of whom had ever married, were buried side by side in the family plot in Oak Grove Cemetery. At the time of her death, Borden was worth over $250,000, equivalent to $5.652 million. She owned a house at the corner of French Street and Beaumont Street, several office buildings, and shared several utilities, two cars, and a large amount of jewelry. She left $30,000to the River Falls Animal Rescue League and $500 in a trust for primordial care for her father's grave. Her closest friend and cousin each received $6,000, roughly $136,000 in today's time frame, spending the sum of the time of the estate distributed in 1927. And numerous of friends and family members also received $1,000, roughly about $23,000 in time, or $5,000, roughly $113,000 in today's time. In common culture, scholar Annie Skolfus noted that Borden's story has tended to take one or the other two fictional forms, a tragic romance and the feminist quest. As the story of Lizzie Borden had been created and recreated through the rhyme and fiction, it has taken on the qualities of a popular American myth and legends effectively links the present to the past. Now that the folk rhyme is Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she'd done, she gave her father 41. Another one who's Andrew Borden is now dead. Lizzie hit him on the head. Up in heaven, he will sing on the gallows, she will swing, which she never swung. She lived up until the 60s. She was 60. She's also depicted in music, radio, film, theater, and television. Last one I noted was with Christina Ricci. Lizzie Borden took an axe. It was developed for Lifetime in 2014. But that is it on Lizzie Borden. Put in the comments if you think she did it or not. I think she did it. It's kind of the OJ case all over. Well, it's a Lizzie Borden case because the only thing effective of the OJ trial was not. So Lizzie Borden was probably the first person to get away with, well, not first person, but got away with legitimate murder. But the problem with the whole thing that happened, if you just reread or re-listen to this episode, is a lot of the criminal investigation, they let her have a day to get rid of evidence because she was feeling ill. Nowadays, that doesn't happen. I mean, the only time frame where a person is able to get rid of evidence is if they don't have a warrant and they don't have probable cause to come into the home, or if, you know, stuff like that. They literally saw her burning a dress that might have had blood stains on them, but it was paint. Anyways, hope you enjoyed the Lizzie Borden episode. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for watching. Check us on a later dates. Love you guys. Oh, and also check up Red Pill Thread, t-shirt company that I interviewed, and it will be out tomorrow. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for watching. Goodbye.